to be still, to look within. You know, the ancient teaching of the yogis is that all the answers live within. We don't have to be like a dog chasing our own tail anymore, thinking that external stuff is going to bring us happiness. That the joy, the love, it's in there. It may be very covered up like gray clouds covering the sun. But that love and that joy, it's who we are.
Now serving love with Govindas.
Welcome home, Colombia. Beautiful, beautiful.
Hello, welcome, namaste, bienvenidos to a new chapter of Now Serving Love. We dedicate this time to talk to individuals who have chosen to use their talents and their voice to uplift the collective consciousness. Today, with the one and only gentle, kind soul of Govindas, an incredible yoga teacher, kirtan singer, owner of Bhakti Yoga Shala here in Los Angeles, California. Overall, a very special, very magical being. Our conversation was so much fun. It was a pleasure. So I'm really looking forward to sharing it with you. And without further ado, here's Govindas.
All right, here we are with the one and only, my dear, beloved brother, Govindas. Hey, hey, my friend, what a gift.
I know, it's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Now serving love.
Honestly, much gratitude for the time, the space. It's so beautiful after all these years that we get a chance to sit down and then just share a little bit, especially such an incredible journey like the one you have partake in the path you walk. So let me start with asking you a very simple, straight question. What does devotion mean to you?
What does devotion mean to me? That is a great question. You know, devotion to me personally, I feel devotion in relation to God, in relation to the divine, in relation to source, in relation to the spirit. And how that shows up for me is in my spiritual practices, in my daily spiritual practices, in the cultivating, as a practice, the cultivating of a loving, just personal, intimate relationship with God, with Hanuman, with Ram, with my guru, Neem Karoli Baba, with Source, with the universe, and this practice of just continuing to peel back the layers of resistance, which that resistance is always in my own mind, and opening deeper and deeper and deeper in the heart of love and gratitude and remembrance that everything comes from God. It's all by God's grace. Just even that we're sitting here, that I woke up this morning, that my heart's beating, that my breath is breathing, that I have food on the table for lunch today, that I have this home to live in, that everything is a manifestation of God's all-loving, all-nourishing energy.
Wow.
So that's how I centrally take them. Now, I feel like I can also see devotion in my life on sort of what maybe we could call it lower levels, like my devotion to my family, my devotion to my wife, my devotion to my work, my devotion to my children. But for me, you know, I associate the word devotion with bhakti, of course, that we practice one of the central yogas. And that is where I have come to learn and understand over the last 20 plus years of what devotion means.
That's such an incredible, profound insight. And I'm sure that, as you say, 20 plus years plus way more, right, got you to this point to have this realization and to have that sort of a definition of what devotion is. So what are you, take us back a little bit from the beginning, as I know you grew up in Maryland.
Yeah, Maryland.
And you
grew up where you spent some time too.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah, spent some time in good Maryland. And you grew up just traditional Western family, Jewish family, correct?
Yeah.
And you just did the whole, elementary school, high school, college, right?
Yeah.
So how was that sort of like growing up?
Well, I grew up in a family that I can say was very loving, but not conscious.
Mm-hmm.
At least conscious in the sense of the things that we practice, you know, in yoga and in our spiritual journey. I grew up Jewish by culture, by identity, but we didn't practice really Judaism so much, at least on a regular day-to-day level. There wasn't much spirituality. My family was very materialistic. It was a material life. That was where we lived. And but I say, incredibly loving, and I'm just so grateful for my family and parents and brother and the way that I was brought up, because there was always just an abundance of love and support in everything. I was an athlete, you know. I was an athlete. My focus in life from as early as I can remember was sports in any way, shape, or form. First soccer, all through my life, basketball, and any other thing that had a ball in relation to it. And it's interesting because my son is identical like that now. It's all he wants to do. And I'm kind of reliving my childhood again because that's all he wants to do is play sports. And I thought I had kind of graduated from that in my life because I became spiritual. But now I'm reliving it and having so much fun with it in a new way.
So Govindas, is that a Jewish name?
No, Govindas was a name given to me by one of my spiritual teachers in the Neem Karoli Baba tradition of Bhakti Yoga. Krishna Das, Ram Das, went to India in the mid-60s, early 70s, came back and brought Eastern spirituality to the West. Essentially, Ram Das turned on a whole, you know, generation of seekers through his book Be Here Now. Mm-hmm. In 1971, I believe, is when that came out. Obviously, Ram Dass passed away just about 3 weeks ago, so we're in this very just tender time. And I met Ram Dass's teachings in about 1997, and my whole life changed.
And with that, so when you were like playing sports and you were in college and stuff, like when you said you're playing soccer and somebody said, hey, pass me, how do they call you?
Ira, yes.
Okay.
Big eye.
The big eye's in the house.
Which is so funny because in spiritual practice, we're trying to dissolve that identity with I.
Yeah.
You know, that it's always about me. And that's one of the reasons that I took on this spiritual name that I was given by one of the elders in this sangha, Raghu Marcus, who's a great podcaster and one of the elder Neem Karoli Baba devotees. And I felt like there was so much wrapped up identity-wise with the name Ira. And it was just, for me, overloaded with everything. And so as I was deepening in this path and I had been given this name and I was going through a very a healing crisis in my life.
This was in Maryland?
No, this was in California.
So let's take it back to Maryland. Where in Maryland exactly?
I grew up in Rockville.
Rockville.
And which that was is a like suburb of D.C.
The 80s?
Yep, I grew up, was born in 71.
Okay.
So I'm 48 now. And I grew up, a suburb of Washington, D.C., which is a quite conservative place when we think about who is attracted mm-hmm. to coming to Washington, D.C. From all over the world. People move there for one thing, and that's pretty much government.
Okay.
And so the whole D.C. metropolitan area is surrounded with people that have that as a very central aspect of their life in relation to, like, maybe look at Los Angeles. People are attracted to Los Angeles. The major thriving business is, you know, Hollywood. And so there's a different vibe. It's a little bit more, you know, relaxed and artistic, where, you know, looking back at DC area, it's a quite conservative place.
So if you would stay in Maryland, we could be right now voting for Govindas for president. Right. So high school, college in Maryland as well.
Yep, I went to University of Maryland.
Okay.
Got a degree in business at University of Maryland.
What was sort of like the environment at that time? Were you listening to Inexus, The Cure?
Yes, I love The Cure. Okay. I love The Cure. I actually, interesting enough, from The Cure, there was an album called Disintegration, I believe.
Oh, yeah.
I found deep spiritual refuge mm-hmm. in that album because of the mood of it. There was such a deep, almost melancholy, longing type of a mood that really allowed me to explore deeper states of emotion and heart that I had. And I always loved music, but that album really in the 80s, I, you know, remember in my high school years, that was a powerful CD for me, album for me.
It's wonderful that you share that. I don't think we ever talk about that.
Because
I also have a very deep connection with The Cure. In
fact, interesting.
I started playing bass guitar because of Simon Gallup, which is the bass player of The Cure. And it was the same. It was just that refuge. So
yes.
So that was one of your the main...
Yes, but in growing up in the 80s, I listened to everything. Mm-hmm. I listened to hip-hop. Mm-hmm. I listened to, you know, reggae. I loved mm-hmm. reggae. Just always was looking, you know, most people were in my age and area were listening to pop, you know, mm-hmm. the top 8 at 8 on, mm-hmm. you know, Kiss FM or whatever the station was. And I was always interested in just alternative types of music that weren't so mainstream. And
so music was always a very important part.
My mom made me play keyboards as a kid and I, piano, and I didn't last very long. And the reason is because I just wanted to be playing sports. So as much as I love music, I didn't have the patience to sit down and learn something. And I was a good student. I got very good grades, but I just wanted to get done with it as soon as I could. I didn't have a lot of patience to really be still.
Okay, so you learn. You had that early age, you have that sort of like exposure to actually play instrument.
Maybe for a year I played.
Okay, so you had that.
I had lessons for a year.
So that whole music was really part of your life, and then you were college.
And then I went to college.
You finished that?
Business, yep. I graduated with a degree in accounting. Mm-hmm. And I was in a fraternity at University of Maryland. And interesting enough, my very first semester, this was a pivotal time. My very first semester of University of Maryland, I took a course, and it was a full semester stress reduction course I took as an easy elective. And I 9 weeks of the course were focused on meditation.
Was that something that
I had no idea.
But does that sort of like led to coming to California or?
Well, that I had no association with anything like that, but I loved it. Mm. I thought it was just the coolest thing in the world. The power of focusing the mind and then feeling, the only way I can describe it, because I didn't have the language to describe it back then, was just more clear. Like I had wiped dust off a foggy, off of a dusty mirror. I just felt the colors of life looked more vibrant when we would finish our meditations. But I was in a different groove, and that groove was essentially a social partying vibe, you know, and that's all I really took away from university. So I finished that meditation course and I went back to just being a partier.
And partier means like?
Meaning drinking a lot, you know, going out every night in the fraternity, always some type of kegs on tap, you know. But I did experience my first psychedelics then. Mm-hmm. I had never even tried marijuana in high school. I first started with marijuana and ganja, and I'm sorry, marijuana, ganja, but then mushrooms as well too, about a year after the meditation. So my sophomore year is when I started exploring these mind-expanding medicines that we now call them. And I remember really in my taking mushrooms, that was where I had my first glimpse of what I could just describe as oneness. Meaning I felt connected to everything, and it felt like the whole universe was a part of me and I was a part of it. I felt the illusion of separateness dissolve during that journey and consecutive journeys.
And that was the very first time you have that sort of experience.
Yes.
Through the mushrooms.
Through the mushrooms. The only way I could ever experience anything like that was playing sports.
Okay. That sense of like being in the zone.
That zone, like, sense of being in the flow state.
Okay,
right.
And so the party, the college, let's take us through last chapter, yes, in Maryland.
Yes.
That led to California.
Last chapter, I had no idea what to do. I certainly felt like I couldn't go and put on a suit and tie. I had used psychedelics enough that my perception changed of life. And it wasn't like every day I was using mushrooms, but okay, over 3 years, 30 times, maybe 10 times a year. But that was enough for me to recognize that there's more to life than graduate college, get a job, and work until I'm 65 years old with a suit and tie, you know, for a 501k so I can be happy thereafter.
It's like, it reminds me what you just said about that scene on a wonderful film, Fight Club, when he's in the shower, the bath or something. He says, I call my dad and I said, Dad, now I finished high school. Now what? So I don't know, I'll go to college. I finished college. I call my dad, Dad, I finished college. Now what? I don't know, get married. Right, that linear sort of like prototype of lives.
Yes.
So for you,
which we've all been at least I'm not sure for you in Colombia, but here in America, we were indoctrinated in that.
Same.
And if you didn't go that route, you were some kind of a failure.
Mm, yeah.
Or a fuck up, or a mess up, or something.
That's the generation we grew up in.
Yeah.
And that was it. So you get to the point right before moving here that you start, okay, there's more to life.
Yes.
And then what was it sort of like?
And so I had a friend that was moving to San Diego to come to law school out here. And I had been to college, and I'm sorry, in college I came to California once, and I felt why everybody comes to California. It's the land of milk and honey. It's the land of the free. You know, I felt that here. The gorgeous beaches, the blue sky, the surfing. I mean, I grew up on the East Coast surfing in Maryland, and I just the consciousness of California being so different, the laid back feeling versus the DC, Maryland, East Coast, New York feeling. I just, somewhere in my last couple months of college, a mantra kept recurring in my mind that said, when I graduate college, I want to live the rest of my life like I'm on vacation.
Okay, that's why we need to buy a t-shirt, bumper sticker.
So the thought of putting on a tie and it just suit and tie and going and getting, I just couldn't do it. And I was like, I'm going to take an what could we call an alternative path. So I came to college. I came to San Diego.
And certainly, like you just mentioned, like East Coast, West Coast, completely different planets.
Yes. Right? Yes. And actually what happened, I came to the West Coast, and I fell into the first depression of my whole life.
When you moved?
When I moved, within a few weeks.
So you were, your friends went to law school, you went to San Diego with him.
I went to him, and suddenly I got to a place and I knew no one. Mm-hmm. I came from being the big fish and...
The big eye.
And then I got to California and I knew no one and I didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And I was extremely confused and I went into a real depression. Mm. And I had no way to handle, I had no tools to handle the situation that I felt, that found myself in, that my mind was just like outside of my body. And the thing that I love more than anything was surfing and being out in the ocean. And even that, I didn't even feel that hit of joy from, because my mind just sunk into such a dark, confused place.
So your depression was a state where nothing was bringing joy.
Yeah.
You felt like just really
low, really low. I've, you know, always was a happy, you know, laughing, joyful person. And I was just confused. And my heart, when I would wake up in the morning, it would feel like there was an elephant on top of my heart. Just like heavy hearted. Like, what did I do? I just moved away from everything I knew to be true. And now I have no idea. It was a clearing of the slate, a cleaning of the slate, a new beginning, a starting over. But I hadn't proactively visioned into the future before I moved, to understand that this was even a possibility, that this was going to happen. Now, this was really interesting. In my confusion, looking for anything to feel better, down the street there was a spiritual bookstore. And in the spiritual bookstore, as I was perusing through it, I saw books on meditation. And I remembered back to that first meditation course that I took in college, my first year. And I remember how good that made me feel. And so I got a couple books on meditation and I started sitting again. And that was the beginning of the healing process. And I've pretty much been sitting every day in meditation since then.
Do you remember any of the books? Like, who wrote
I remember one of them. I remember was Jon Kabat-Zinn, a very famous book, "Wherever You Go, There You Are."
Mm.
It's a very Buddhist psychology books.
Beautiful.
That were greatly helpful for me to see, like, using the psychedelics, we were experiencing the mushrooms, these great awakenings, but we didn't have a language in which we could understand these teachings that we were getting from these plant medicines. And even though it was in the guise of partying, when we were taking mushrooms, there were still really deep, for myself, deep awakenings that were taking place. So this spiritual language that these books were speaking in, it was like I immediately understood it from the journeys that I had been taking via the mushrooms, and as well too from the meditation class that I had started with. And so that's, again, where I found like a rock of support, being able to sit, center, quiet down, separate myself from this crazy mind, and see things from a more of a neutral, unhooked perspective. And
so this is the point where you reconnected with this technology of meditation, mindfulness.
Yes.
And how long was that period? How long you stayed in San Diego?
And so I stayed in San Diego and for 2 years. And during
what were
that
you doing
time,
in the meantime?
Oh, so I took a job as a salesperson.
So now you're wearing the tie and suit.
No, I wasn't wearing it. It was pretty relaxed. I was selling t-shirts like a company that did screen printing and embroidering, but they also had their own t-shirts and sort of upscale nice stuff, embroidered things with logos on them, and then we could print or logo or embroider on shirts for other companies as well too. So I was, I was cold calling, walking into businesses. It was difficult. It was really difficult.
Let me take a moment to picture that.
I know, it was brutal. Uh-huh. It was brutal. Oh, gosh.
I can imagine you did that, right? Hello.
Hi, I'm Big Eye.
Here comes Big Eye.
Oh, my gosh. And so I stayed in that for a couple years. But a couple of things interesting happened. I was moved into a new place and I needed a roommate.
Still in San Diego.
In San Diego, a couple blocks from where I was living. And a friend said, oh, I know a friend that needs a place. And she hooked us up, me and a guy who moved in with me. We moved into the small apartment. His name was William Georges. And he was the first spiritual person that I ever had a connection to. He was an artist, he was a designer, and with a very spiritual outlook on life. And I had never met anybody like this. He just had a different way of looking at the world, an expanded state of awareness. And he meditated, he was a musician, he was a music creator. He was creating before anybody was doing this, like ambient music with beats, and this was in 1994, and before, you know, electronic music had become really popular. And he was just on another plane of consciousness, this guy, but such a kind, generous person. He embodied all of this. And before he would go to bed every night, he would listen to a dialogue on an audio tape of Deepak Chopra and Wayne Dyer.
The early stages of podcast.
Yes, this is exactly what's happening right now. And so they had this dialogue together, and he would be in his room, put it on every night going to bed. I would be in my room going to bed at my room. And I remember the first 2 weeks he would do this, I would be like, in my mind, like, very aversive to it. Like, oh God, what is he listening to? Please turn this off. You know, what are these guys talking about? And then gradually, I started to actually hear what they were saying. And what they were saying were things like, when the student is ready, the teacher will appear. Mm. Everything happens according to the cosmic. Mm. There are no mistakes. And in a few weeks, I would be knocking on his door. Can I come listen to this video?
Hey, in 30 years from now, there's going to be a guy on a podcast that, well, I used to live with this roommate.
This guy played
every night. This conversation between this guy, Govindas, and Andres Salcedo.
Yes.
And they would be like, what?
Right.
I love what you mean. And in a sense, remember that conversation with Deepak Chopra and when he says, okay, there's three ways to manifest. If I want an ice cream, well, I can get up, go to the shop, and get the ice cream. And they were having this conversation, yeah. Strawberry ice cream. Second way, I can just be at my place, chill, relax. I can concentrate to the ice cream. Somebody can, right, walk by, knock at the door and says, here's your ice cream. And the third one is simply manifesting from thin air, which is something that they share, that we all have this sort of like ability. Right? Yeah. And now it's like all like a little bit of like, and all the spooky stuff and fairy tales, but it's something that we all, every single human being has the ability to manifest from thin air into material.
Yeah.
And that's what, you know, the great teachings.
Yeah, I love that story as well too. And,
so you are
it's,
going
it's
back.
It's sort of like I guess just he's Deepak. He talks about do nothing and basically manifest everything. That's what we're learning.
The art of non-doing.
Yeah, non-doing.
Just being.
Just being.
Just being. So you were listening. You ended up going that this guy and what.
And so we spent about a year or so living in the same apartment together, and it was my first introduction to satsang. Satsang means keeping the company of truth. It's a yogic word. It's a very essential part of the yogic tradition, being around like people who have a similar path and do similar practices so that you can support each other. And even taking it a step further, as Ram Dass used to describe it, as a spiritual family. Spiritual family.
Spiritual family under the breast of the divine.
Yeah, isn't that beautiful? Mm. And so I stayed there, but I started to feel this, just something was pushing me on. And I was dating a girl at that time.
Oh, and, here we go.
And she was moving. She lived in Los Angeles. Mm-hmm. So I said, okay, why don't I try Los Angeles? But before I did that, I said, I'm going for the summer to travel. This wanderlust feeling of wanting to see the world. I loved traveling. I'd traveled a lot in America, but I'd never been overseas. So I said, I'm going to Europe first, and I travel around Europe, and then I'm going to go visit the roots of where I come from. I'm going to go on a spiritual pilgrimage to Israel. And then after Israel, I'm going to go to Egypt. So I spent 2.5-3 months traveling and went to Israel, went to Egypt, and never really found what I was looking for. I felt like an outsider. I felt like I was looking from the outside in. And as much as it was nice to see the sights and, you know, be in the quote-unquote holy land of Israel, I never felt at home there. Interesting enough, like now, since then, going to India 20 times in the last, you know, few decades, like I realized that is what I was looking for at that time. I should have not gone to Israel, but gone straight to India, because that's always felt like home to me.
That sounds like go where you think you have to go to realize where you really have to go, right?
Yes, absolutely. But now the interesting piece of that puzzle is while I was in Egypt, I got very sick. And it was 130 degrees, and I found myself in bed for 8 days in southern Egypt in a little town called Aswan, all by myself, puking my guts out, diarrhea, sick as a dog, nobody around. And this little tiny hotel, and after that, I couldn't get back quick enough to America. So, and that was right at the end of my journey, and then I came back to America, and I moved to Los Angeles. And in moving to Los Angeles, I moved into the Hollywood area, and the girl that I was dating was a couple blocks away, and it didn't work out between us, but it got me to Los Angeles. And interesting enough, it was a few months of being in Los Angeles and not really sure what to do with my life at that point. I had saved a little bit of money in San Diego with the job that I was working, that it gave me a bit of freedom to come to Los Angeles and not have to stress so much. And a couple things happened. One is I was walking down the street and a girl said to me, You need to be in the movies. She said, I'm an agent and I want to represent you. I am a commercial agent. Are you interested? And I didn't have a job. And I was like, yeah, I went in Rome, you know, went in I've never had a drop of experience doing that in my life.
You were like, yeah, nice to meet you. I am Big Eye.
So I started doing
commercials. Hey, that's a really great name, by the way, for some other kind of film. Film star.
I didn't go there. Let's say that. I didn't go
Big
there.
Eye.
Which happens in Hollywood too, or is that North Hollywood?
Yeah, yeah.
That's the Valley.
Five never surrender. Three with Big Eye. Never give up.
So I did some commercial auditions, and I made some money doing it. And I booked a few gigs, you know, commercials, and so I could live every day like I was on vacation and not have to work anymore and spend my days smoking marijuana and living the Hollywood life and enjoying. And you know what happened though is that I started going, I had a few friends from the East Coast here, and they were in a music, you know, like a rock and roll band, and I started partying and going out and drinking again after what I was doing in San Diego, was doing deep spiritual practice. You know, this was what my focus was. Coming out of that depression, I knew that this was, God, I love this. And me and my roommate and was having authentic spiritual awakenings. And then I moved up to Los Angeles and was going out to the Hollywood clubs. And it was like, did not feel good underneath it all. And it was soon after that that I got very sick, and I was, terrible pain in my tummy, and, you know, all kind of symptoms from diarrhea to blood in my stools, and my body basically stopped working, I couldn't understand it. Here I was, 24 years old, and my body always as healthy as anybody, strong, athletic, and suddenly my body stopped working. I was like, what? And I went to a doctor, and a doctor said, you're going to be on this medicine the rest of your life. And whoa, was that a wake up? And I realized, okay, I have to separate myself from this Hollywood way of living and slow down and get back to what I was doing in San Diego. And so I started doing that again, and moved out of the place that I was living with my buddies in this band, and I moved to the west side of Los Angeles, to Venice Beach, actually. And a friend at that time said, you need to go to a yoga class.
The same that was telling you need to act.
Different friend.
Yeah. And
yes.
That's a very powerful sort of statement, in a way that it's so common that we walk through this path and we find this connection with mindfulness, with stillness, with, right? And then many times we kind of take a detour,
yeah,
and we go back to maybe these models of, oh, this is what is joyful for me. This, yeah, is what I like. Maybe we go, you know, party, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And then we eventually realize this is what is really serving me. This is what I... And sometimes it can be out of free will, sometimes it can be out of illness, yeah, or some, yeah, sort of what we call negative, challenging experience. Yeah. And that's something very important, because especially in the sort of like spiritual path, a lot of people have this illusion that it's all like, yeah, butterflies and pink and fluffy, yeah, right? But there's so many.
And even wellness now.
Mm.
You know, how wellness and spirituality are mixed together, and somehow people think wellness is like, oh, pampering yourself and massage and it feels good all the time. Oh, go get another green juice or smoothie from Erewhon. But no, it can be some very deep, dark, challenging stuff. And I think actually most people that are brought to spirituality, it comes through some type of unexpected challenge, mm-hmm, whether it's death of a loved one or an illness or depression, or that something pops and we're forced to look outside of our normal ways to something else that can, where we can find, yeah, health or joy or peace. Or,
and you know, that's so powerful in a way that people think that only the positive, right? We want to in some way avoid the negative. I only want to look for the positive, what makes me, yeah, feel good. I don't want to, yeah, experience challenge. I don't want to feel discomfort. But in reality, this universe is made of polarities and positive and negative.
Yeah.
And sometimes the negative, I thought about the other day, what if you go for a cancer test and comes back negative? Isn't that the most positive day of your life?
Yes, yes. Right? That's true. And the interesting thing that exactly in relation to what you're saying is that this most negative thing in my life brought me to yoga, became the most positive thing in my life, my life path, my life mission, my life dedication, my life's work, my purpose. Now, interesting, looking back at one of the reasons why this even happened is because I was living life without purpose. I was so confused. I had gone back into old ways, drinking this. There was no root. There was no root chakra. There was no purpose in my life. And I got sick, really sick. And that was the doorway back into purpose, which then healing over a long period of time took place.
Hmm. It comes to the back to the narrative of your story. It reminds me, I call it UPS, like the delivery service in the UPS, unseen personal system. Mm. It seems like in the journey, there's always this sort of like angel entity, whatever you call it, that shows up in your life. Now this time, it shows up in the form of this friend telling you, okay, you need to teach yoga.
Yeah. And this was really interesting because a mantra that came out of this whole experience that I still use today is, the challenges are gifts in disguise to help us learn and grow from. Any challenges that come our way, we have free will to choose how we're going to perceive it. Most of the time, poor me, what a pain in the ass, this sucks, why me? But if we can just make a little flip in our perception, okay, what's this here to teach me? How can this help me? Whereas Ram Dass would teach, this, how can this be a part of my curriculum and my vehicle of awakening? So,
that's such a powerful mantra. Yeah. Very powerful mantra.
So yeah, so this has been the journey, and then it was through that you know going to a yoga class, coming out of the yoga class, feeling this is what's going to help me in this healing process. This is going to help me transform and reshape and go to the depths of my being, whatever I need to do, so I don't have to be another person that accepts the statement from the doctor that says you're going to be on this medicine, you're going to be a slave to this pill the rest of your life.
Mm. And then fast forward from that moment to today, you have this incredible journey, beautiful journey, where you've been teaching yoga, leading sessions, going, leading up in main festivals. Now you have, I don't know how many, lost the count, how many kirtan albums. You go around the world sharing this medicine. You're in this place right now where you're Bhakti Yoga Shala, an incredible, beautiful hub of just wellness at all level. Just last year, 10 years anniversary.
10 years. 10 years.
So incredible that purpose that you had, that moment where you understood that life of party and so on this was not fulfilling. This was your mission by surrendering, by just being present. He has unfolded into this moment. And I think it's beautiful because that sort of like ties back to the whole devotion. Right? Yeah. You were devoted to your experience, to your truth.
Yes. Yes.
And it has led to this moment.
Absolutely.
So when we talk about the devotion aspect, we talk about the sort of like what you call God, what you call spirituality in that level. But you also mentioned, which is very important, devotion to your family, devotion to what we call maybe lower realms.
Yeah.
And so how that translates into your life, like let's say, and your life as a husband.
Yeah. Well, there's many different levels that we can look at all of this. Mm-hmm. And in this path of bhakti, there is a deep association with this word, this devotional path of yoga.
For the listeners, yeah. What is bhakti?
Bhakti is one of the main paths of yoga.
Okay.
And so, yoga means union with God.
Okay.
Tools that we have to unite our lives with spirit, with love, with truth. Bhakti is one of the main styles of yoga. Bhakti means the path of devotion. You know, using this energy of love through which we can practice in our lives and do practices that connect us to our heart.
Okay.
So our loving, devotional heart.
Loving, devotional heart. So let's say if I'm in downtown LA, want to go to the Pacific Ocean, meaning that ocean is the source, there's going to be many roads, many paths that I can take,
yes,
to arrive to that ocean.
Yes.
So bhakti, this path of love,
path devotion, of the heart,
path of devotion, the heart,
yeah.
It's a path that I can take.
It's a path that we can take to union, to God.
To get to that ocean, to the Pacific
Ocean. Yeah, to get the ocean.
Ocean,
to the ocean, the infinite ocean of God's grace and all intelligence, love, and beauty. So this is what the ancient seers, the ancient masters, the ancient saints, the ancient rishis, yoga has been on this planet, some people say up to 10,000 years. So bhakti is one of, you can take the subway, you can take you can walk, if you're in downtown LA, you can take a bus, you can drive in a car, you can grab an Uber.
Well, the bird now, scooter.
Bhakti is one of those methods that you can take to get to the metaphorical ocean of self-realization.
And in that sense, how, because I think it's very interesting, especially because this path of bhakti, devotion, coming from the East, mainly India, those of us who had the blessing of be in the physical presence in India and have been exposed directly to great bhakti experience. How that, in a way, for someone who's like mainstream Western, living this type of life, it's very interesting. I want to ask you because, and I go back to Ram Dass' story. You know the story you probably hear. I heard from Ram Dass, the story of Sumbak the tailor.
Mm-mm.
You never heard that
no.
story? No. Oh my God, it's the best. I think it's Sumbak or something. I might be changing the name. But so the story goes is like this guy that wants to get this suit made for him. So he goes to the Sumbak, the tailor, this is in New York, and he gets this fine fabric to get this suit made. And then finally he gets a call, okay, your suit is ready. He goes to the Sumbak, the tailor, he's standing in front of the mirror trying the suit, and then he says, Sumbak, but what's going on here? The sleeve is like 2 inches shorter. And Sumbak, the tailor said, no, my good man, it's just the way you're standing. So, okay. And Sumbak, but what about this extra fabric here in the around the neck? My wife is not going to like that. It's, no, my good man. It's just the way you stand. So anyway, the guy ended up like barely can't even breathe. Like he's all like twig and turn, right? And he walks out of there with the suit and he's walking on Fifth Street, get to the subway. And then this guy comes and says, oh my God. What a beautiful suit. And the guy barely can even, talk. Like, oh, thank you so much. And he say, I bet that that's a Sumbak suit. And the guy's like, how do you know? He said, because only a man like Sumbak that has such an incredible talent can fit a man as crippled as you are.
That's... classic Ram Dass.
Classic Ram Dass. And yeah. Then he goes to say like, oh, I love Krishna, but I'm so fucking miserable. You know? Oh yeah, I'm a follower of Jesus Christ and everything, but I don't care. You know, it's sort of like we try to fit into the suits
yes.
because we think that that's going to lead to heaven or,
yeah.
you know, that we, so it's in that way, this sort of like devotional, because a very Indian culture, right? They have been practicing this active path for so many generations, is in their blood and stuff. So to take that into the Western world, which is a very different culture, and we see so much people that try to fit into this suit, and it becomes so like miserable. It just becomes sort of another. You change one sort of like impediment to another, is like go from one jail to another jail.
Yeah.
There's not really that sense of, right?
Yeah.
So how do you define that, or how do you would try to translate that into this Western sort of like world?
For me, it the integration really is in the heart. It's in my own personal practices. It's in my my meditation. It's in, you know, my own yoga practice, my daily, regular daily practice, where I can just continue this reshaping of my heart, in a sense. I just, that word really helps me to understand what I'm doing. In the quiet time of my practice, that I can get into that bhakti, that devotion in its purest sense. Even days where I'm just crying in gratitude, because the grace that's present, the blessings that are present. And that's a practice. We can choose to see, you know, again, complain about everything, or we can choose to practice seeing the blessings that are present in life. That's my practice.
So which practices, like for someone who is just starting this or doesn't have too much exposure, yeah, which practices can help them cultivate this sense of devotion, connection, this sense of bhakti, yeah, the path of the heart.
Well, you know, I think meditation is a great place to start, just to quiet down enough to really be able to see what's in there. Because most of the time we're so busy running around and living in the external world that we really don't know what's the content of our own minds and our own hearts. And then if we do have a moment of seeing, we don't like what we see, so we run away from it. And this on some level is what all of doing some kind of practice is about. Commonly we're running away from our realities. And so we decide, okay, I'm going to do a practice, which means I'm going to get still. And instead of running away from my reality and what I'm feeling and what my thoughts are and what is in my heart, I'm going to turn towards my heart. And I'm going to turn in to all of it instead of run away from it. I think that's the very first step in all.
To quiet down.
Just to quiet down. To be still. To look within. You know, the ancient teaching of the yogis is that all the answers live within. We don't have to be like a dog chasing our own tail anymore, thinking that external stuff is going to bring us happiness. That the joy, the love, it's in there. It may be very covered up like gray clouds covering the sun. But that love and that joy, it's who we are. Mm-hmm. Who we are. It's who we are. It's the essence of our being. And now this has been taught, and I think this is, for me, a central aspect of it, that it's been taught through the ages and through the ages. So we start to open up to just being a student, to being a teacher. And now for me, I found that through Ram Dass and through Krishna Dass. That there's people have walked this path for a long time and taught these great teachings. And where, for whatever reason, I heard it from Ram Dass and it was agreeable to me. Hmm. He spoke about it and taught it in a way, in a language that I could hear it and I could digest it and I could receive it. And same as Krishna Dass as well too. So that for me is, I follow the teachings that somebody else that's been walking this path longer than me have taught. Mm-hmm. And they have gotten it from Maharaji, from Neem Karoli Baba.
Certainly when you mentioned these names, Krishna Dass, Ram Dass, such an influential, pivotal teachers in our generation, and some great sort of vessels into taking what we're talking about, taken all this incredible wisdom from the East and bring it into the West in a way that we can understand, we can relate. And Krishna Das, Ram Das, yourself, myself, deep connection, deep sort of like inspiration through the great saint of Nim Karoli Baba Maharaj and his instruction in how to elevate that bhakti, to really practice the bhakti was or is through serve people, feed people, contribute. So regardless of whichever walk of life, whether you can be the sweeper, you can be the lawyer, you can be the yoga instructor, you can be anything within your experience of life, serve people, contribute. That's, I guess, an easy one for everybody. Start like by helping, serving, contributing, give, right? Yes. That's a powerful way to really experience that sense of bhakti oneness, that sense of openness of heart, correct?
Yes, and to bring it, I think, all back together, you know, that you can take an Uber from downtown LA to the ocean. You can take the scooter now. You can take a cab. You can take a bus. You can take a subway. What the ancient scriptures of yoga, they say that of all the yogas, of all the methods, that this bhakti, with these very simple teachings that you just said, is the most direct form. The love everyone, the serve everyone, the give, the remember who we really are as spiritual beings living in a human body. I mean, I know that brings on a whole nother conversation, but these simple, simple instructions. And that's all we have to do.
That's all we have to do.
That's all we have. It's not about being a good meditator. It's not about, you know, even as much as we love chanting, learning fancy mantras. It's not about raising our kundalini. It's not. It's about being a good person and loving everyone and serving everyone. And it's and that is enough that will take you as far as you need to go. Mm-hmm. On this journey. Mm-hmm. And that's what bhakti is all about.
So for the listeners, if you want to travel first class, nonstop, journey, take the path of bhakti, of service, be as simple as being the most decent, the best person you can possibly be. Certainly, we're going to have to continue with. We can do a lot of these talks because, like, we can talk forever.
It's
such a joy to sit down and converse about, and such an important topics that are so crucial in this sort of new vision that we're attempting to create, leading with a humble heart, leading with gratefulness, and above all, love.
Well, I think, you know, I can only quote, and it's not my words, but the words of Neem Karoli Baba, and it's everything that we're talking about, is love is the strongest medicine. And love is what heals us. Love is what transforms an ordinary life to an extraordinary life. You know, love is the elixir that just turns this human realm into a magical, magical place when we do even the simple things like sweeping, when we put love into it. And that's where we find the greatest form of joy. It's not going to come from the new car. It's not going to come from the bigger home. It's not going to come from the new sex partner. Yes, God, granted, those things might give us a temporary lift. But that deepest sense of joy, purpose, it comes from living our life with love. And, you know, Ram Das, he was extraordinary with words. extraordinary with words. And in his passing, you know, I'm listening to so many different lectures of his, and in his later life he became, because he had a major stroke, he'd become a man of much fewer words than he was prior to the stroke. And of all of his teachings, the one that's sticking out for me now, more than any of the others, is maybe the simplest I've ever heard him teach. And he says, and this with this exact tone, love, 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 love. And that's it.
And so, that's it. Love, 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 love. Well, if you wanna catch this beautiful soul and leave in presence, there's the Bhakti Gashala and the Heart of Santa Monica serving 24/7. And now with the new, speaking of Ram Dass, every Wednesday at 6:30 p.m., new Ram Dass class where there's gonna be some meditation on Ram Dass, some satsang. Now we learned that word, right? Where a group of people get together. There's going to be opportunity to talk, to share. There's many, many albums of kirtan, which is beautiful, beautiful way also to connect with the heart, and where you and your wife, Radha, sing this devotional chant, so you can listen to that as well. Where else can we catch Govinda's and Radha and all main festivals around the planet? And any last place where we can be in your company and shower from the wisdom?
Well, you know, my favorite part of the year every year is just our yearly trip to India, where all of these different things that we're talking about, somehow going to India, it gives you the experiential reality of it, to see this culture. Because, you know, look, a lot of India is just trying to be exactly like America, but we go to these very ancient towns where Bhakti yoga is practiced first and foremost. We meet great saints and great teachers, and so it gives us a firsthand experiential reality of living it and seeing it. So I love to invite everybody to come on that trip. That's every November over Thanksgiving time. And
so that's November. You have coming up Bali in March.
Bali,
Costa Rica.
Costa Rica, Peru, where we do plant medicine. Ayahuasca and Wachuma, and we integrate those with yoga and bhakti yoga and chanting, which is a great retreat every year. So lots of good stuff.
Lots of good stuff. Yeah. Teacher trainings, bhakti trainings,
kirtan training. So just
so where people can find you. The best way
to, the easiest is Instagram.
And you know, you are this under, way,
it's govind.das.108, or just our studio's Bhakti Yoga Shala on Instagram. And I don't know, it just seems like Instagram is the simplest way. It's
at govindas108.
Yeah, govind.das.108.
All right. Well,
what a pleasure.
What
man.
A pleasure. What a gift. And we have to do this again for sure. Because I think we're just touching the surface.
Just touching the surface.
As I say in SpiceJet and India's main airline, it's been a pleasure traveling with you. It's been delightful. And I wish nothing but more light, more life, more opportunities to serve and to contribute. Ram, 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 ram.
Thank you so much, brother. Thank you so much.